This is lesson 19 on our fourth section of the miscellanies, and this will be the end of the miscellany section, and the following three lessons will take up Proverbs 30, then 31, and then a summary lesson at the end. So today I thought I'd take a few verses that I think either don't mean what we think they mean, or we don't have any idea what they mean. And in the middle, we'll take up a section on things that appear contradictory. So let's start with a verse that's bothered me for a long time. Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. So what does that verse mean? At first glance, what's your initial impression of as to what that verse means? Ben?
With the right parenting style, you are guaranteed godly, solid children.
The right parenting style, guaranteed godly, solid children. Yep. What else?
Oh, and I'd like to give you a whole set of what the right parenting things
are. That's right. Yeah, there's yeah. What else do you think it means? Okay. Let him do what he wants. When he's older, he'll continue it in rebellion. So the Message Bible says, point your kids in the right direction. When they're old, they won't be lost. Geneva Bible says, teach a child in the trade of his way, and when he is old, he shall not depart from it. That's different. Young's says, give instruction to a youth about his way. Even when he is old, he turneth not from it. But the Arabic Bible in plain English, which I was completely unfamiliar with, says, he that reproves a boy concerning the beginning of his way, even if he becomes old, he will not turn away from it. Well, I think even at face value, these five different translations don't say the same thing. There's something going on there that needs some further investigation, and unfortunately, the investigation requires a lot of nuance in Hebrew, I think. So, one translation says, and this is sort of a more toward a word-for-word literal wooden translation. They're not made to be readable, memorable type. Dedicate a lad upon his mouth's way, moreover, for he will age not depart from her. That's the underlying Hebrew, one translation. Another is, initiate for the child on the mouth of his way, even when he is old, he will not turn from it. Well, that looks very different than what we have with the English version. I think the Geneva, teach a child in the trade of his way. The Arabic version of, he that reproves a boy concerning the beginning of his way, at least hints at the dedicate a lad upon his mouth's way, or initiate for the child on the mouth of his way. So this is what seems so obviously simple in English turns out to not be very simple at all. And what this verse is communicating, I think, is subtle and may need some explanation. So let me ask you, first of all, what comes to mind when you see these two Hebrew transliterations? When you read these things, when you read dedicate a lad and initiate for the child, what comes to mind? What changes in the verse do you think may need to be made? What hits you? The mouth? Okay, yeah.
and the initiation, or somehow there's an implication that there's a beginning, and we're talking about the beginning.
Okay. Anything else?
Dedicate seems to imply giving the lad to something or someone, so giving it over to his mouth way or something.
Yeah.
Direct the child the right way to speak.
Okay, yeah. Anything else?
It seems way is there too, probably more than just what you say.
Yeah.
Well, I just wonder if mouth is his way, or mouth's way, if that's really a Hebrew slang or
idiom
for the beginning, and that's the way it's translated.
Mouth's way, perhaps an idiom for beginning, okay?
Certainly, if you're eating something, that's a start.
Yeah, okay. Anything else?
Mouth's way might, this is just speculation, to have some sort of indication, like putting a bridle in the mouth, directing him.
Putting a bridle, yeah. Okay, directing that way. All right.
It seems to be still, the English translation seems to be faithful to this if then kind of concept.
Okay.
So do this now, later this.
Okay, so the if then, the consequential aspect of the proverb seems to be intact with English. So the idea of training, I don't know exactly where that comes from. I don't know why training means dedicate and initiate. I'm not sure what lad is, right? Lad, is it a child? Is it an infant? Is it an adult male? There's some questions there. In English, we get he should go. Where does that come from? Where do we understand he should go? I think part B of the verse, I think we can agree on this, that part B isn't nearly as confusing or difficult to translate as the first half. All the English translations seem to convey that when he is old, that consequence, he'll not depart. So I don't think there's a lot of confusion about the part B of 22:6, but part A seems to be somewhat questionable. Dan Phillips, in his book, he really takes this verse to task. You could tell this is important to him. But he quotes a fellow named Douglas Stewart that says, "The more well-known a wording in the Bible is, the more hesitant modern translations are to depart from it." And there's certainly some safety there too, right? I mean, we don't want everybody just making up their own translations for the sake of novelty. But I've been surprised at the number of commentators that don't appear to me to be working directly with Hebrew. And it comes out in a verse like this because what's happening underneath it requires some thought and some subtlety to it. So let me give you a few of the dominant theories on how we should think of this verse. And there's been a lot of ink spent on this one verse. So this isn't all of them, and I suspect the proponents of these theories might be upset with my characterizations, as they're very brief, but the first one is the promise extended view. This gets to what Dan was describing, but Ted Hildebrandt wrote an extensive paper on this, and he describes this as this promissory view which has brought encouragement, hope, anxiety, and guilt to countless parents who have faced the uncertainty and the confusion of child rearing. It has provided encouragement to those responsible parents who, after working to balance family, relationship, and careers, find reassurance that all their labors ultimately will not be in vain. This verse has also provided rays of hope to those who, having reared their children the best way they knew, have had their hearts broken as their child rebels and goes astray. So there's this promise that if you do the right thing, your kids are going to turn out. And you should have hope that if you tried to do the right thing, that even though your kid doesn't demonstrate any of the faithfulness in their walk now, they'll be okay. But ironically, not everyone draws comfort from this promissory view. Another group of young parents, sensitive to the daily feelings of inadequacy, experiences intense anxiety over the possible long-term damage they see themselves doing to their child. If the child goes astray, this verse seems to point the finger of guilt straight at them. So these are folks who are not comforted by the promises that seem to be extended in this verse. So right there ought to give you some pause that there's some confusion as to how to think about the verse if the promissory view also has two subviews to it. So the commentator Wardlow weighs in on it, and he describes the strength of this promise, that is, the he will not depart section, this way. He says, the language is strong. It is so strong that one is almost afraid to qualify it. Inasmuch as professedly Christian parents are so sadly prone to lay hold on any qualification of the words and to make a pillow of it on which they set their consciences to sleep. At the same time, I cannot regard them as containing an absolute assurance that in every individual instance in which the means are faithfully used, the result will infallibly be as here stated. So he's torn, obviously. This promise is so unqualified and so strong that everyone ought to be set at peace, but yet he can't seem to believe that that's really what is being conveyed here. So already, just looking at the promissory view has problems attached to it, and people not quite sure what to do with it. So Dan Phillips makes a good point as to how people read this verse. He writes, to get this meaning as a most unqualified promise, going back to what Wardlow was saying, we must take the Hebrew's literal wording, his way, and replace his with some sort of modifier such as good or right or he should go. Likewise, commentators assert that the reference must be to the right way, or the proper way, or the way of wisdom. But you see, there's no qualifier for the way, right? They're telling us what way the kid's supposed to be on. And we're placing words there to indicate what we think it should mean, which is actually a problem with all of Hebrew. I mean, Hebrew is a dense language, and we take away meaning from it, based not on necessarily the precision of the words that underlie it, right? I mean, so we can say this word. Bridget and I were in a discussion about the unnecessary use of a modern, especially in business or in political speech, of dialogue as a verb. And her point was there's nuance between converse and discuss and dialogue that is helpful. That dialogue has an aspect that other words don't. Well, that level of precision and nuance just doesn't exist with these types of words. And so we've got to figure out what they mean at a higher level. So Phillips cites the lack of a modifier beyond the pronoun to weigh. His is there, and it's not in uppercase either. We're not sure. The classic pronoun refers to the child, or the closest pronoun refers to the child and not God. In other words, it's the child's way that's being discussed, not his way, but his is in God's, but in the child's way. So the second, that's the promissory view. The second, and Phillips has a problem with it, and I think rightly so, but the second view would be called the age-appropriate view. And the age-appropriate view has this idea that the child needs to be trained in a way that is appropriate for his time and station in life. So the first institution, let me give you an approximation of this view, the first instruction should be after the measure of his way. So that's the focus of the verse, on the measure of his way. That is, not of his calling, which he must by and by enter upon, and also not of the way he must keep during his life. So it's not his calling, and it's not the way he should go, nor of his individual nature, but of the nature of the child as such. So this comes from commentator Delitzsch in his work on Proverbs. So he's not looking at the calling the child has, and he's not looking at the direction the child should be going, but the appropriateness of instruction to a child at that station in life. The education of youth ought to be conformed to the nature of youth. The manner of instruction ought to regulate itself according to the stage of life and its peculiarities. And method ought to be arranged according to the degree of development which the mental and bodily life of the youth has arrived at. So it's this idea that you're training a child in a way that's appropriate. And that would accommodate some of the latitude involved with the idea of what does it mean by child? Do we mean a small infant, or do we mean a lad in his early 20s? And the word there has a great span to it. So child does not even refer to a baby in this case. So he continues that this translation refers to the training of youth in conformity with his nature, which is, or perhaps because, becomes a second nature, that which is imprinted, inbred, and accustomed. So by teaching a child according to the capacity of him at that stage in life, then you're imprinting upon him what's important in the lesson. And what Solomon is getting at here is the need to be appropriate for the type of instruction for the child. Does that make sense, that age-appropriate view? So you don't treat a 2-year-old like a 20-year-old, and you don't treat a 20-year-old like a 2-year-old. You're working with them in their capacity. So Phillips, he takes this view apart for three principal reasons. I'm broadly summarizing these things, so there's a lot of nuance and detail here that we're skipping. That if you take this view, train up a child in a way he should go, the fundamental problem is that line B doesn't make any sense. If you train up a child in an appropriate manner for his age and capacity in life, then what's he departing from when he gets old? Where is that point of departure? Is it from the manner appropriate to his age? Well, that doesn't really make sense. So that's one problem with this verse, is it is a couplet. Two, training may not even be a good translation of this word in this verse anyway. Initiate and start out are better than translate. So the idea of regular training throughout the kid's life doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, because that's not what the word means. Third, this view is at variance with Solomon's other view of his way in Proverbs. And I don't list those verses, but Solomon, remember the chief metaphor here is way and path. That's the metaphor that we work with so frequently in Proverbs. And his way is not taken in an age-appropriate manner throughout the book of Proverbs. If anything, Solomon's warning about this kid needs to get knocked loose from his way, right? He needs to adopt my way, not his way. So the third view, this is one that Phillips holds. He cemented this idea in my mind. This is the view I subscribe to. There are some other commentators that hold this idea, and I think it makes sense. I don't want to definitively state this is the only way of looking at this verse, but the third view could be broadly summarized as saying, neglect him and just see what happens. Okay, so Proverbs is consistent in teaching that one of the jobs of a parent is to knock foolishness out of a child, is to get it away from the kid, to put the kid on the right way by removing folly from him. So the neglect and see what happens view says that if you do not teach your children, if you do not give them the instruction they need, they will continue on the way they originally started on, and they'll never depart from it. So the idea is that when a child is initiated in his way, it's the parent's job to knock him out of the way and put him on a different path. And if you don't do that, you shouldn't be surprised years later when the kid is continually walking in his way. So I'm going to read one last quote. I know there have been a lot of quotes here, but I want to read one last quote that I think was real helpful that I had completely forgotten about. But Phillips brought this to my attention, and if you remember the book Competent to Counsel by Jay Adams, he has a quote on page 158 that I thought was really helpful. It was actually, I believe, part of a footnote to to the passage, not even the main part of the passage. He says, train a child after the manner of his way, summarizing there. He says, that is, after the standard or manner in which he wants to be trained. The verse stands not as a promise, but as a warning to parents that if they allow a child to train himself after his own wishes, permissively, they should not expect him to want to change those patterns when he matures. Children are born sinners, and when allowed to follow their own wishes, will naturally develop sinful habit responses. The basic thought is that such habit patterns become deep-seated when they have been ingrained in the child from the earliest days. The corollary to this passage is found in Proverbs 19:18, where the writer exhorts the reader, discipline your son while there is hope. Do not set your heart on his destruction, which we looked at just recently. So there are three views for you. I really like this view. I think Adams is being very consistent in his outlook, the authentic outlook in counseling. I think it fits well. Maybe I'm just predisposed to nothetic methodology and think that way. But that seems to make the most sense for how to look at this verse. So there you go. Three different views. The promise, which has its own variations, the age appropriate, and the warning that Solomon is giving. So, any comments or questions? Jeff?
I've heard this view many years ago. I remember hearing it from Greg Bronson, because it's more like a threat of what, you know. But I think it seems to me that either view, as long as you understand that Proverbs, even if you take the standard English translation, this is more of an observation of how things usually go in life, but not some kind of promise to you that if you just do X, Y, and Z, this is how it's going to come out. Thankfully, it's not if you take the last view, because there are plenty of children raised in foolishness who, by God's grace, are converted. Right? So it's, but in the normal course of events, yes, that's what happens. Also, I think in the normal course of events, if children are trained properly, you know, it benefits them later in life. So I have sometimes heard people take things like this and act as if it either must be an absolute promise or, well, then what are you saying? Don't you believe the Bible or something? You know?
Right.
And I think wisdom literature is full of things that are, yes, in the normal course of events, this is, you know, this is the way things usually work, and you should be aware of the woman with honeyed lips and so on. But it's not, things don't always turn out the way in that sense. It's not that kind of promise or, you know, definite, this is what will happen, like, you know, as if it's some kind of spell book that if you just read this and do this, voila, this, and you get this outcome. It's not that kind of literature.
That's right.
It's not formulaic.
It's not formulaic, that's right. Yeah.
Same is true. I remember talking about that in the study with the CYD and trying to update during this study. I think there's lots of other verses in the same way. Jeff's point there. Talking about the wealth, work ethic, and the wicked, and the righteous, and so on, and these principles that are there, but are not, they're just not one-to-one absolute formula. You necessarily do this, you will necessarily be monetarily wealthy, or will not be. Lots of wealthy, wicked people, for now, you know, and so on, but it's definitely the principle of the family. It maybe helps encourage more dependence on God too, because it seems like even though you're depending on His word, when you believe the, if you were to believe the promise, absolutely, I'll do this, and my kid necessarily turned out this way. On the one hand, you could say, well, I'm standing on God's word. That's why I believe He's going to turn out this way. So that does seem kind of like faith, you know, like maybe there's something. But I wonder if when you realize the more that, I guess what I'm getting at is you just still every day depend on God to bear fruit by this thing you're trying to do, that feels like it bonds you more to a daily dependence on God to really cause the fruit to be born, even though you're still trying to stand on it.
Sure. Yeah. Are we good? All right.
The Geneva translators in their note on that place the trade that they had. Mm-hmm. They say, bring him up virtuously and he shall serve them.
Right. Yes.
They seem to have taken it positively.
Right. That's right. All right, well, let's go to another verse, two verses, Proverbs 26, 4 and 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you also be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. So, which is it? Do we do 4?
Yeah, I've actually heard people quote this to say the Bible, you know, contradicts itself.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, this is often listed as one of the contradictions in the Bible. So I hope to at least work through it to show that there's at least a reasonable explanation as to how it's not a contradiction. So Proverbs doesn't have a lot of context, for the, especially in this section. And we see these verses together. So I deliberately put some extra space there to say, first I have to answer the question, do they belong to each other or do they not? I think they probably do. But more importantly, Proverbs, the opening of Proverbs 26 has some instruction and context with this idea in mind. So a whip for the horse, starting in verse 3, a bridle for the donkey, and a rod for the fool's back. And then do not answer a fool in 4 and 5. He who sends a message by the hand of a fool cuts off his own feet and drinks violence. Like the legs of the lame that hang limp is a proverb in the mouth of fools. Like one who binds stones in a sling is he who gives honor to a fool. Like a thorn that goes into the hand of a drunkard is a proverb in the mouth of fools. The great God who formed everything gives the fool his hire and the transgressor his wages. As a dog returns to his own vomit, so a fool repeats his folly. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? There's more hope for a fool than for him. So there's some context here that I think actually is helpful. So starting in verse 3, there's only one remedy that is appropriate for a dumb beast, right? Dumb beasts need correction, and in order to get that correction, dumb beasts will continue acting in a contrary way until they're corrected. But the correction that comes to a beast is different. Each beast is treated differently. So here you've got a whip for the horse, you've got a bridle for the donkey, and you've got a rod for the fool's back. It's not that just any correction will do. You need the right kind. You need tailored correction to the individual circumstances and their constitution. There's no generic correction. Each beast responds to specific tools. And that's, I think, the idea here is why the fool is included, is that he's acting like a dumb beast. He's not walking in the fear of the Lord. He's acting as one of the base animals. And that's, I think that's why he's included here. Well, that's one of them. I believe Proverbs has 5 different types of fools. So it's important to distinguish those. So in verse 6, we see that entrusting a fool with wisdom turns out to be a useless endeavor. 7, fools can't even make use of wisdom. In 8, the fool can't even load a sling. And in 9, the fool is senseless with what he has in his hand or within his grasp. So these verses all speak to the idea that the fool, while in the possession of wisdom, cannot handle it, deliver it, he can't wield it, he doesn't even understand it. So wisdom is a liability to the fool, it's not an asset to the fool. So when we look at according to his folly, in verses 4 and 5, it might be helpful to remember that the part A of both verses seem to say the opposite of each other, right? Do not answer a fool according to his folly, and answer a fool according to his folly. But the second half, part B of those verses, are not the same thing. Lest you also be like him, and lest he be wise in his own eyes. That doesn't say quite the same thing. The two verses are not precisely opposite one another. And so Wardlow offers this idea that the warning given in verses 4 and 5 suggests that it's the matter and the manner of the fool that needs to be discerned. So in verse 4, the warning is lest you be like him, which is not the same thing as lest he be wise in his own eyes. So Wardlow sees that in the opening, or the second half of four, is a warning that you're going to become like the fool if you're answering him in the wrong way. So if you answer a fool according to his folly, you become like him in matter and in manner. And then you will pass for a fool yourself. He describes it this way. He says, a man enters into a foolish, frothy, absurd, contemptible talk of the silly, the vain, the worthless, chiming in with, encouraging, and countenancing their folly, and seeming to relish and enjoy it. So when you answer the fool according to a foolish way, then it becomes impossible to discern who's the real fool. We don't see wisdom anymore. All we see is a pair of fools. So under these circumstances, how would someone from the outside looking at the two of you be able to determine which one was the native-born fool and which one is acting like it? So the goal is to not answer someone in a way that makes you similar in nature to them. So the idea then Wardlow has is that if you answer a fool according to his folly, means to answer him according to the way his folly deserves. So you're trying to give him correction that's appropriate for him. You're trying to help him work into wisdom's way in a manner that's appropriate, like we saw up in verse 3. So this is a little trickier than maybe what first comes to mind. So you might decide to simply ignore the remark or the comment that the fool has made. You might try to strongly rebuke the offender. You might ridicule his question, or you might quietly refute him. So which technique do you use? What's the proper method for handling this type of foolishness? And it's not as simple as we'd probably like it to be. It's not so easy to know what to do sometimes. So Wardlow wisely exhorts us to remember that our goal is the reclamation of the fool so that he will not walk in his ways, and the goal is not merely to win an argument. So in the end, this proverb is more about correcting a fool in a way or in a manner that doesn't make it difficult for people to see that there's a wise man and a fool. It makes it difficult for them because now you're acting just like he is. So when you answer him, when you correct him, you're looking for correction that's suitable for the circumstances so that you will be discerned as someone different than he is. So there's no contradiction in Proverbs 26, 4 and 5. So what do you think? Does that sound like a reasonable explanation of those verses? Does anyone still think there's a contradiction there? Or good?
I think it's really helpful that you point to the big parts. Yeah. I thought
of that before. It makes a big difference. Yeah. Part B sets Part A in motion. All right. So this last section, I've got a slew of verses, and I have no real comment, but I'm curious. 27, 15, and 16. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. Okay. I think these verses need to go together. Otherwise, the pronoun in 16 doesn't really make sense. Is it hard to imagine the parallelism between the dripping on a rainy day and a contentious woman? Is that hard to understand?
That's easy to understand.
I think it's easy to understand. But
sitting on the porch yesterday next to the gutter and it just kept on dripping.
It just kept on dripping.
It never would stop.
It wouldn't stop. That's right. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grass oil with his right hand. What does that mean?
You can't do it. You better not marry a contentious woman.
You better not marry a contentious woman. You can't do it. What's that?
Or a dripping gutter.
Or, yeah, that's right. Any other ideas? I think it's a strange verse.
So. Contentious man also.
Doesn't say that. All right. Proverbs 27:17-19. He who passes by and meddles in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a dog by the ears. That's bizarre. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. So is 17 related to the 18 and 19? And how is a madman like a deceiver? So two questions for you. Is 17 part of 18 and 19 or not?
Those include meddling or messing with other people, not yourself, getting in other people's business.
Okay, getting in other people's business.
I feel like each one's conclusive. 17 seems conclusive and 18 and 19 seems conclusive.
They do. They do seem to contain a whole thought. What else? How is a madman like a deceiver?
People have hurt themselves. Other people.
What? It seems obvious that the madman's doing a lot of damage, perhaps with his words or physically. But the deceiver sometimes, you might not realize he's doing damage because he's only joking. We have a lot of that attitude in America right now. I'm just kidding. It was a joke.
Right.
You know.
Okay.
I insulted your mother. I was just joking.
Gotcha. Okay.
I think it may point to the seriousness of the deceiver. That this isn't just a silly thing. You're like a madman.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's good. You're like a madman. Right? What else? Dan?
Just keeps coming back to the foolishness, the trouble in someone who can't just focus on his own problems. He's got plenty of work to do. He's got plenty of planks in his own eye. He just can't help but get in everybody else's business. This is very tempting. It's in media and a lot of television and so on. I think not just soap operas, but those and other things are. Reality shows tend to, I think, thrive on this sort of thing, but it happens on social media. Everybody, it happens in the office. It's a very unproductive thing. I have this whole set of things. Take a whole lifetime for me to solve my own problems if I were focused.
Right, that's right, yeah.
I'm not even going to spend any of my time really working on that because I'm going to get in your business.
Right.
About all your things. And it's very hard to not just go there and spend all your time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Part of the point that the madman doesn't understand what he's doing when he throws these things, and neither does this person who deceives his neighbor messes around. Same lack of understanding.
Yeah, he may not understand how it affected someone. Yeah, that's good. Well, those are really good. We have more. Proverbs 22:4: The mouth of an immoral woman is a deep pit. He who is abhorred by the Lord will fall there. And the comment I make here is, do we get the causation backwards? Does the man become immoral because of his association with the immoral woman, or is it the other way around? Why did he fall into the pit?
Because he was already abhorred.
He was abhorred by the Lord. Yeah. So we can look at something like this and say, going to the immoral woman, you know, makes you immoral, right? And it does. But we could also, I think, more reasonably say, because you're immoral, you're going to end up with the immoral woman in a deep pit. We might have this cause and effect backwards when we think about issues of sexual immorality.
Or sin in general, right? Are you a sinner because you sin, or do you sin because you are a sinner? Goes back to the original sin. You act according to your nature.
Yep.
It's already there.
Romans 1 says we fail to give God the glory he's due. We're not thankful. And then this leads to these other things.
I think that Romans 1 reference is very appropriate for this. I do. Yeah, that's good. Three verses here, 10:16, the labor of the righteous leads to life, the wages of the wicked to sin. 21:4, a haughty look, a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked are sin. 12:10, a righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. So one question that comes to mind is, why is the plowing of the wicked sin? That's the first question that comes to mind. Yeah, there's no one who does good. I think so, sure.
He's a haughty, proud man. He's doing it in his own confidence and not acknowledging that the Lord is giving him the strength to do it. Perhaps.
Yeah, I think it's a, you know, if you think about it, it's the haughty man, it's the proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked is sin. It's worded in kind of an odd way. I don't know. I think all three of these speak to the nature of individuals and what naturally comes out of their heart. Why are the tender mercies of the wicked cruel? I mean, here we talk about the righteous man regards the life of his animal, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. How are the wicked's tender mercies cruel?
Dead to the cruel person or the wicked person, so you're not really free or you weren't really helped, you're just in debt to someone else now?
No, I'm not sure that. I don't think that's not my takeaway from this. My thought is that this verse contrasts the righteous man. He's on the right way. He's got the right way of thinking. He can even take care of this animal, which is insignificant, right? That he regards the life of the beast. He knows what he's doing just with this simple animal right here. But the contrast is the wicked. Even their tender mercies are cruel. So there's a contrast into the way and the path again. That the wicked are not on the right way. They're not on the right path. Their ways are just wrong. I think we see how the wicked often have intentions that sound good and noble, but they end up being very destructive. There are lots of government policies, for instance, that would reflect this. And I think what Solomon's getting at is even the tender mercies, even the simple things they do, can often go very, very astray.
I mean, let's consider China real quick. China wants unity. They want their people to be together and at peace, I guess. And so their tender mercies is to persecute these Christians, which are causing these uprisings, killing people. And that's their mercy for their people. You know, it's just they're so wrong and ignorant. They have no idea what restoring life is.
Mm-hmm. Do you have something over here?
Well, yeah, it's just for wickedness. I think, you know, the wicked are inevitably self-centered.
Right.
And a lot of the tender mercies of the self-centered are things that they, in a sense, can do that make them feel better about themselves.
That's right.
And, you know, we see this in all kinds of things. You know, I want a Toyota Prius.
Right.
You know, I'm environmentally conscious, you know. I just got to leave it at the airport while I'm jetting, you know. Jetting off all around the world. So I think that, and since they're self-centered, they often don't even view that the things like Jonathan mentioned, you know, they don't view that these things that they're, quote, doing for good may be actually being cruel because they don't see anything beyond themselves.
Right.
I don't know if that's, I doubt that exhausts the meaning.
No, I don't think so. I'd like to, we're just about out of time. I have just two more slides that I want to briefly touch on here. 11:16, a gracious woman retains honor, but ruthless men retain riches. What's the comparison here between these two? They each have their reward. And what was the second part?
The fitting of their actions.
Yeah. Yeah, according to their actions. I think so. Honor and riches are certainly being compared, right? That's one comparison. I mean, the other is women and ruthless men, right? I mean, this is a contrast at different levels, right? So you've got the woman in honor and you've got ruthless men in riches. So it's a little different that way. It's an interesting verse.
Yeah, but given the other proverbs about the wealth of the wicked being saved for the righteous and so on, I would interpret this as being retaining riches in an immoral manner.
Sure.
I don't know for sure, but that's what I...
No, I think that's very good. Yeah, that's right. And this last slide is just the oddness of Proverbs. I don't have comments on it, but consider 15:23. A man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. The problem is, there's no verb in that proverb. We talk about an oddly named thing. The proverb doesn't have a verb. 15:23 literally is joy to the man in an answer of his mouth, and a word in time, how good. Proverbs 12:11 doesn't have a verb. Whoever loves instruction loves knowledge, but he who hates correction is stupid. The lover of discipline, the lover of knowledge, and a hater of reproof, bullheaded. That's what it says. 15:32, he who disdains instruction despises his own soul, but he who heeds rebuke gets understanding. A neglecter of correction, a rejecter of life, and a hearer of reproof, an acquirer of will. That's what it says. We should all be thankful for English translations. Shouldn't we? I mean, isn't that helpful? Yeah. There may be more. Those are the only ones I could find that had a translation that made sense. So Proverbs is a difficult book for sure. All right. Running a little over. Let's close in prayer here.